the roadless rule will be beneficial to us because of being able to access future hydroelectric sites.
Mixed reaction as the Forest Service rethinks how the roadless rule applies to Tongass National Forest. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, August 3rd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Matsu residents will vote on whether the borough should consider providing local police officers.
A policeman who goes by your house at 55 miles an hour once a week doesn't do a blinking thing about stopping crime.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, investing in Alaska by hosting local interns and donating to University of Alaska programs like the UAA Summer Engineering Academy. More at bp.com/Alaska.
An Anchorage man has been detained in eastern Russia and told government officials there he floated across the Bering Strait in a rubber one-person boat. The Associated Press reports that, according to Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova, 46-year-old John Martin told officials he had been traveling down the Yukon River in the boat and ended up in the open Bering Sea. He said he spent several days at sea in bad weather, eventually washing up on Russian shores where he was picked up by border guards. At their closest, Alaska and Russia are separated by about 55 miles. It remains unclear, though, what route Martin might have taken. He was detained Thursday by Russian officials in Chukotka. The U.S. consulate in Vladivostok was informed about the incident, and U.S. diplomats are aware of the situation, as the BBC reports they are working with Russian officials to resolve it. Russian media reported Martin was in the port town of Anadyr for questioning. He allegedly did not ask for political asylum, as previously reported. Zakharova, the foreign ministry spokesperson, told reporters Friday in Moscow that Martin's condition was satisfactory. Alaska's state-led liquefied natural gas export project could be impacted by an ongoing trade dispute between China and the U.S. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, Rasha McChesney has more.
Alaska's Gasline Development Corporation and Governor Bill Walker's administration are minimizing the potential impact of a tariff on the state's liquefied natural gas export project. China, the project's largest potential customer and investor, is threatening to impose a 25% penalty on imports of LNG. Gene Theriault is in government relations for the state's Gasline Corporation. He wrote in an email that the corporation believes the trade dispute will be resolved before Alaska LNG exports to China. The LNG tariff is the latest escalation in a tit-for-tat trade dispute between the U.S. and China, and the move ostensibly threatens the financial viability of the Alaska LNG project. A 25% penalty would make Alaska's gas significantly more expensive for Chinese customers. It's not the first time a tariff has threatened the project. The Trump administration levied a tariff on Chinese steel imports. That could impact the state's ability to find steel for the project's 800-mile-long pipeline. Governor Bill Walker's office also emailed a written statement calling the trade tensions short-term. China's Ministry of Commerce announced the LNG penalty as part of a $60 billion package of tariffs. If carried out, it levels penalties on thousands of U.S. goods, from beef to lumber to auto parts. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rasha McChesney in Juneau.
On Thursday, the U.S. Forest Service said it was taking steps with the state to allow new roads to be built in the Tongass National Forest. It's been a decades-long battle. Elizabeth Jenkins of Alaska's Energy Desk spoke with people who have mixed feelings about the announcement.
Mike Duville has lived on Prince of Wales Island his entire life, but he says the island doesn't look the same. Now, there are large clear cuts where old-growth trees used to be. He'd like to see an end to industrial logging, at least in his lifetime. So hearing that new roads could be built in the Tongass, which would increase access to timber, was a huge disappointment.
You got to look at the impact they have on wildlife as well as people that live here. And I've said this before, I've lived here since 1949. And all the trees are standing when I was a kid. Now we don't have that much left.
But logging isn't the only reason the Forest Service and the state want the ability to build roads in the National Forest. There are communities in the Tongass that don't have clear cell phone reception. Greg Mickelson with Alaska Power and Telephone doesn't provide cell service, but his company could potentially provide the electricity if there were new roads.
Personally, I think, you know, because I'm in the power business, the roadless rule will be beneficial to us because of being able to access future hydroelectric sites.
By roadless rule, Mickelson means roadless rule exemption. Though the Forest Service has already allowed some exceptions for hydro projects like this in the past. But Mickelson says the ability to construct new roads in the Tongass is also important for local economies dependent on timber and mining. The last large mill on Prince of Wales Island, for instance, is the utility's biggest year-round customer.
We're all in this together. You know, I'm not an anti-environmentalist, but I also know that people have to be able to have a job if they want to be able to live.
People don't come to Alaska to see clear cuts.
That's Dan Blanchard, the CEO and owner of UnCruise Adventures, a small luxury cruise line. Blanchard says tourists want to experience the pristine wilderness of the Tongass. Road building unchecked could hurt commercial interest. But he's not opposed to new roads being built entirely. And the state has said it will include tour operators in the conversation.
So with that, I feel a lot more comfortable, or maybe not comfort isn't the right word. Maybe I don't feel as anxious.
Blanchard says he's open to hearing more dialogue. A state-appointed committee will discuss road building in the Tongass for the next 2 years. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
Matanuska Susitna Borough residents will vote this fall on whether the borough should consider doing its own policing. The borough assembly voted this week to put the question of whether the borough should look into providing police services on the October 2nd ballot. The borough cites rising crime in the region and a decline in services from the state. Ideas to solve what some have described as a crisis ranged from expanding the city police department service areas to giving the borough policing responsibilities themselves, possibly even something like a sheriff's department. Other ideas include contracting with the city police departments or the state to provide more state troopers. Borough officials and language in the advisory question itself acknowledge adding police powers would require higher taxes for police service areas. Assemblyman George McKee has opposed the idea of putting the question to voters. McKee said at Tuesday's assembly meeting that he and others want the state to, quote, do their job of providing law enforcement to the borough. McKee says the advisory vote will create an expectation that the borough can deal with crime effectively.
We are a rural area. A policeman doesn't walk a beat here. A policeman who goes by your house at 55 miles an hour once a week doesn't do a blinking thing about stopping crime.
Despite objections by McKee and Assemblyman Randall Kowalki, the measure passed 5-2. Borough Mayor Vern Halter said he did not support it, but said he would not veto the measure. The borough election is still set for October 2nd, but in related news, the borough clerk this week certified a ballot initiative that aims to change that. Voters will also be deciding whether to move the borough's elections from the first Tuesday in October to the first Tuesday in November. That's when statewide general elections are held and turnout is generally greater. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage experiments with curbside compost pickup.
Anything that we can remove from the landfill and use in the community in another way is a benefit to everybody, really.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
Generator problems have meant ongoing power outages for Tuluksac over the past month. Lack of electricity to operate freezers means many people have already lost their summer subsistence harvest, and the problem is expected to continue into early next week. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports.
For one resident, living in Tuluksac is like living at a giant fish camp.
You know, when you're living out in a fish camp, you have to have a generator, or some people would bring a generator.
Angela Alexi hears the motors of generators running day and night in the Lower Kuskokwim community. The power has been out for about a week. Earlier in July, it was out for another week. Alexi's generator is small and can only run a few appliances at a time. She has to buy more diesel every day to fuel it, and it's not big enough to run her stove or her freezer.
I had to take some of my fish out and take it over to my parents' freezer before I lost everything.
Her dry fish should be fine. She's whipped her salmon berries into a gudeg to prolong them, but Alexi has not been able to save everything.
All my half-dried fish, the zamach, look that I had to feed to the dogs.
Alexi has lost about a quarter of her subsistence fish. That food is shared among four families.
My parents, me, and my two other sisters.
She's hoping for a strong silver salmon run to help replace what was lost. However, the drying weather in August is not expected to be as good as it was earlier in the summer. In Tuluksak, not every home has a generator. Alexi's parents bought hers 2 years ago after another week-long power outage wiped out her fall and winter subsistence catch. Multi-day power outages are a frequent problem in the community, and residents have become frustrated with the inconvenience and cost.
Here and there, there's more generators every year in the village.
The Tuluksak Native community operates the power plant. Parts for the broken generator are expected to arrive in Anchorage on Monday. Reporting in Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
The commission that manages the polar bear population shared by the United States and Russia has increased the quota of bears that can be harvested by subsistence hunters. The U.S.-Russia Polar Bear Commission increased the harvest level for bears in the Chukchi Sea from 58 to 85 bears split between the two countries. The decision came after the commission heard new estimates of the bear population. The commission met last week in Chukotka, Russia. The executive director of the Alaska Co-Management Council, representing Alaska tribes that hunt for polar bears, says that does not mean more bears will be killed. Katya Wasily says Alaska Native hunters in recent years have not reached their quota of 29 bears harvested from the Alaska Chukotka population. Alaska collected more than $11 million in marijuana tax revenue during the state's 2018 fiscal year, exceeding projections by nearly $2 million. The Associated Press reports the Alaska Department of Revenue released numbers Wednesday for the fiscal year that ended in June, indicating an upward trend in revenue collection. The state collected about $1.7 million during the previous fiscal year. According to the department, the state collected the most revenue from marijuana taxes in June at more than $1.2 million. The department expects July to break that record. Kelly Mazze, the department's excise tax supervisor, says tax revenue has been increasing steadily each month. Half of the revenue from marijuana taxes is directed into the Recidivism Reduction Fund, which aims to pay for programs that reduce relapses into criminal behavior. Horseback riding and a carving studio. Those are some of the services offered at a new recovery center that opened near Aklutna, north of Anchorage, yesterday. A packed house filled Cook Inlet Tribal Council's new Ernie Turner Center for the ribbon-cutting ceremony. The traditional winter homes of the Dena'ina people inspired the design for the open two-story space, which sits on a six-acre lot. But the services there will be available to both Alaska Natives and other Alaskans. The facility will offer six-month-long inpatient services for those recovering from addiction. CITC President and CEO Gloria O'Neill says a retreat is exactly what they had in mind when they decided to move residential services from Anchorage 2 years ago.
So it becomes more of an oasis, and not only are people, you know, engaged with their recovery, but they also get to connect back to nature and themselves.
The old Ernie Turner Center in Anchorage is now owned by South Central Foundation and will focus solely on short-term detox services. Both add to larger efforts to combat the opioid epidemic and substance abuse in Anchorage and the Matanuska-Susitna region. O'Neill says they've upped their recovery support services by 40% since the governor released a disaster declaration last year.
Unfortunately, there's such a need in the community, but how can we do what we do well and ensure that we're that partner?
The new facility uses a model that is rooted in Alaska Native traditions and focuses on community building and peer support. Aklutna's Village Corporation sold CITC the land and was involved in the construction of the facility. Aaron Leggett is the village's president.
It's a huge need for our community. It's long overdue, and we still need more, obviously. But when we all come together, it really strengthens us as a people and our community in general.
Current regulations limit the facility to 16 beds, but CITC hopes to expand to accommodate long waiting lists. Residents will move in as early as this weekend. Pink refuse bins have made an appearance in Anchorage this summer, but they're not for trash. They're part of Solid Waste Service's curbside pickup program for compost. Alaska Public Media's Aaron McKinstry went for a ride along collecting those grass clippings and table scraps and has this report.
So you ever been in a garbage truck before?
I can't say that I have.
It's raining as Garrett Fairclough hoists himself into a massive red truck and starts filling out paperwork. He pulls out of the central transfer station, makes a pit stop for coffee, and we're on our way. He starts in the College Village neighborhood and then follows a map he made himself around the city. One man stares at us in confusion, worried that he's forgotten trash day. But he hasn't. Instead, Fairclough's on the hunt for pink trash cans filled with yard waste and food scraps. He's one of two drivers picking up for the 280 customers participating in this summer's curbside organics pilot program. Everyone who signed up in time and met the program requirements was invited to join.
When we were passing the cans out, we had people coming out asking how to get the pink cans because they wanted in on it, but they didn't respond to the mail out.
Fairclough dumps the organic material off at American Landscaping at the end of his route. They turn it into finished compost, a nutrient-rich soil amendment that can be added to gardens. Aside from wet grass sticking to the bottom of the cans, a stray piece of styrofoam, and having to figure out a new route, he says things are going smoothly. Solid Waste Services recycling coordinator Susanna Caldwell says they've collected more than 14 tons of organic material since the program started in June.
Generally, organic material makes up about 25% of most residential solid waste. You can take that, turn it into compost, and then use that compost to continue to grow more food versus just sending it to the landfill where it just decomposes and takes up space.
She says community garden groups and customers urged them to look into more options for composting. So they collected yard waste in one neighborhood last summer and started a program where people can exchange 5-gallon buckets of food scraps for finished compost. This summer's pilot program expands services further and could lead to curbside composting for their entire service area, which covers nearly a quarter of the city.
This is just one piece in helping us figure that out for the long term.
Solid Waste Services is footing the bill for the $7,000 program using the Recycling Fund, which adds $1.50 to every ton of material that passes through the landfill. They'll know more about what a service area-wide program would cost after the pilot program ends in October. But Caldwell says customers would pay a fee for the service, just like with recycling and trash collection. She says giving them the option is important.
You know, you go down to a lot of other communities in the lower 48 and you see a lot of organics collection, right? That's been happening for a really long time. We want to make sure that Anchorage is forward thinking and staying ahead of the curve.
That's important to program participant Edith McKee, too. McKee grew up in Anchorage and has been composting on and off since childhood. But she can't throw food scraps in her backyard pile because of her dogs.
And so this is the 5-gallon bin that comes from the program. And so you put your food scraps in here.
A banana peel, strawberry tops, and bits of greens fill a white screw-top bucket behind her house. McKee dumps it in the pink bin the morning of pickup, and so far she hasn't had any issues with bugs, smells, or wildlife. If she could change anything, she says, she'd get rid of the biodegradable bag that lines the bucket and expand what's allowed in, like citrus, weeds, and compostable containers. She sees the program as a step in the right direction.
Anything that we can remove from the landfill and use in the community in another way is a benefit to everybody, really.
Solid Waste Services will start analyzing the data from the pilot program when it finishes in the fall and hopes to expand next year. Year-round curbside compost pickup for all customers could be on the horizon. In Anchorage, I'm Erin McKinstry.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechmiut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Wesley Early. This week on AK, changing landscapes. Quartz Lake is shrinking. The water level of the popular lake just north of Delta Junction is dropping. And while researchers try to find out why, archaeologists are studying how humans have adapted to the lake's periodic cycles of increasing and decreasing water levels since they moved into the area 14,000 years ago. KUEC's Tim Ellis reports.
Ooh, first pull.
Josh Ruther navigates his small boat out onto Quartz Lake en route to the eastern shore to drop off his friend, Wendell Schiffler, at his cabin on land he bought in 1972. That's when the lake, which has no surface water inlet or outlet, was about 1,500 acres. Schiffler says he's seen a lot of changes over the past few decades.
And that's where I docked the boat when we first got here. So you can see this has gotten shallow. And the lake has gone down just in the last couple weeks. The water's dropped a little bit.
Schiffler's a retired high school science teacher who lives in Fairbanks when he's not at his getaway cabin. He says the shoreline has receded as the lake's water level has dropped, and that enlarged his parcel from 2.5 to 3 acres. It also required him to extend his boat dock another 50 feet or so to get into water that's at least knee high, deep enough to keep small boats from running aground. And he says some of the other 50 people or so who own cabins around the lake have had to do the same thing.
You know, when people ask me, you know, property owners say, oh, what are we going to do about the lake going down? You know, what can you do? Well, we adapt, that's right. And so I build another little section of dock out a little bit further.
Human adaptation to changes in the lake is what Ruther and his fellow researchers have been studying, though they're looking farther back at how humans who've inhabited the area over the millennia have changed their diet in response to the lake's periodically changing water level.
It's risen and fallen, Over the past 9,000 years, just continually.
Ruther's an assistant anthropology professor at UAF and curator of archaeology at the Museum of the North. He and other researchers have for 10 years now been excavating sites around the lake, looking for clues on how humans have found other sources of food because of the water level changes. He points to one site just offshore in shallow water near an old dock he tied his boat up at on the northern end of the lake, where archaeologists have found such artifacts as European trade beads and stone tools.
We radiocarbon dated the thing, so we knew they were within the last 150 years. So we're thinking it's about 1840 to 1860 is when people were on the shoreline when it was down.
Ruther says bits of bones and other evidence show moose were slaughtered at the site. He says that suggests they were killed while grazing on a type of grass that grows in shallow water, preferred by moose and other big game, including the bison and elk that lived here some 5,000 years ago. He says the animals move on as the area dries up and alder and willow overtake the grasses.
Then the shrubs come in and take over these grasses. That's actually taking over feed for grazers like bison.
A bit farther up the slope, a team of students looks for more evidence of adaptation. One of their instructors is Fawn Carter, a Museum of the North staff member. She's working on a dissertation on why early inhabitants apparently turned to fish as a protein source some 1,500 years ago when a volcanic eruption blanketed the area in ash.
Is that related to this sort of climactic change that we see associated with this volcanic eruption, potentially a big caribou die-off in the area or in the Yukon? Did that make people turn towards fish as a more important resource, or were people just attracted to it for other reasons?
During a coffee break in the cabin next to the dig, Ruther says it's important to study how humans have responded to climate change driven by forces of nature over a geologic timescale, because he says it might inform our understanding of changes that are occurring during a time of accelerated climate change triggered by human activity.
Whether you have global warming or whatever, the ecology is going to change either way. It's always in flux. And when something changes, we want to know how humans are changing themselves, how they're responding to that change.
Ruther hypothesizes that the warming climate is thawing permafrost more deeply in Shaw Creek Flats, an expanse of wetlands just north of Quartz. He says that draws water from the lake toward the Tanana River to the west. And he says warmer temperatures increase evaporation. Others say a decline in the area's beaver population due to excessive trapping has led to fewer beaver dams being built in the flats, which would slow the movement of water from the lake. But so far, there's no study on how modern-day humans are adapting to the many changes, besides building a longer dock. For AK, I'm Tim Ellis at Quartz Lake.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Tom Huddleston in Copper Center. Huddleston owns and operates the Copper Center Lodge, which has been in his family for 70 years since they bought it from the Mon Edgecombe School.
In probably about 2000, my wife and I, as our kids were getting older, we were trying to figure out how they were going to get a work ethic. So we decided to start looking for a business to buy so the kids could work in it in their teens. My aunt called me up and asked me if I'd be interested in the lodge. And that's where we went. We bought the lodge in 2002. And my brother Pete, Kimberly, and myself, and all my kids, we got it up and going, and it's been going ever since. We don't have any taxes here, which is really nice. I mean, I don't know what it would be like to have taxes because I've never had taxes, but I hear plenty about it. And we're free to add on to our homes or do stuff without having to go get a city inspector. And we don't really understand that, but I hear that, and I'm glad I don't have to deal with that. I think I live in the best place in Alaska because I'm centrally located. I'm 100 miles from Valdez. I'm like 260 miles from Fairbanks. I'm 180 miles from Anchorage, 150 from Palmer. I'm kind of right in the middle. It works pretty well. There are a lot of stories about this place. There's the haunted stories of the ghost. I have not seen the ghost. There's been lots of strange happenings going on. I know people that have seen the ghost. I know people that have heard the ghost. I know lights. I've seen lights come on. I've seen doors left open, doors locked, keys missing, keys reappearing, all kinds of stuff. And we just kind of attribute it to the ghost. There was a guy that was in here not too long ago and kind of a slick looking fella. And when he found out I was the owner, he asked me what my number was. And I didn't understand what he meant. I told him I wasn't sure what he was talking about, and he asked what I wanted for it. At that point right there, I realized that this is my grandparents' lodge. It's not my lodge. Just out of respect for those people and what they did to me and were there for me in my life, I don't want it to leave my family. I'd like it to stay right here.
Tom Huddleston lives in Copper Center. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Tim Ellis and Aaron McKinstry. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Wesley Early.
That is all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Emily Russell and Aaron McKinstry in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.